how you would have a budget, a clear default, strong long-term budget in this area. It's hard to think of a way, in my mind, about how we're going to solve this problem and deal with it in any other way. So if you think of it that way, and if you think about some kind of budget and how that might work, it seems to me that there are three sort of basic ways that a budget could function, could be distributed. And this is just simplifying, but still gives you a general idea. And each of them has a different locus of control. Each of them has a different dynamic about how decisions will then be made. One approach, of course, is to say, well, this is the amount of money. Let's distribute it in some way to providers, to hospitals, and so on, and say, you know, here's your money. Just kind of live within it. We sort of do that in any case in capitated systems. But in terms of large systems, this is kind of what we do in the UK and in Canada and some other countries. And so the locus decision moves to the providers, really, to figure out, you know, who's going to in the line for people for operations, who's going to come first and so on. You would have to do it in that way. I think that raises questions in this country about whether Americans would be willing to have their health care, and particularly elderly Americans, in this way. But I leave that open for you to think about. The second approach in principle would be to say, let's have some independent body in some way, and this is really the IPAP, of course, in the Medicare reform, in the ACA, that says, okay, we're separate somehow from the political system. We are in such a way that we can make decisions with regard to payment levels and prices, but you have a kind of an independent body with the budget, kind of ratcheting down in various ways within the system. And the idea explicitly in that is to have a body that's separate in some way, as far away as possible from the political system, so it's not manipulated, so that Chip Khan and his hospitals can't come along and do anything to it, like get it unelected next time or something like that. So that's the idea, the logic of that. And then, of course, the locus of decision-making ultimately is within that board. And then thirdly, the idea of putting the budget in some way into the hands of the customer, the beneficiary, whatever word you want to use, to say, well, okay, we've only got a certain budget. You be the locus, the primary locus of decision-making about what happens, who gets paid, how much, and so on. And that's the logic of that thing. So I want to just spend, really, I mean, we can talk about the first. I want to spend a little bit more about the second two and just sort of think these through a little bit further and share some thoughts with you. If you look at the sort of independent mechanism, the idea of an independent commission, essentially the IPAB model, it relies on the idea of this agency or board making kind of micro decisions with regard to pricing and so on. But I think those of us who've looked at that, and I think most people would agree that in order for that mechanism to solve the kind of problem that Rick is alluding to, even under the current law, the commission that we currently have, the IPAB, can't do this job without some very significant changes. It would have to be able to use it would have to probably be more independent. Some have argued for that and say it should be even less connected to Congress, that it really would have to be able to do something which is precluded from law from doing, which is to say, well, let's actually figure out what is cost-effective and use that as the criterion. That's because, you know, Republicans are real nervous this will turn into something like NICE in the UK, and that would be sort of arbitrary decisions by the government and so on. But you'd really have to do that in order to move in this way. And some argued that you would really have to extend the same mechanism into the private sector so that you don't just get cost shifting and so on undermining the effects. So you'd have to do these things or some combination. So you have to ask yourself, do you think Congress is going to do that? And do you think the American people would agree with that? And we can obviously talk about that. The third approach, which I must admit I'm drawn to, is to look for some kind of mechanism that has the customer, the person who's the bottom line in terms of judging value for money and getting the service, ultimately being the primary locus of control. And that does move you to thinking about the generic idea of a premium support type of system or things like it. And let's remember that you know, this has a fairly long bipartisan history. It's had variations and so on within it. But in order to try to put into place some kind of premium support or defined contribution model, I think it's important to recognize what you're trying to do, successfully or otherwise, is try to hit three goals simultaneously. And it's not easy, of course. One is to get the basic number to work out from a budget point of view. So whatever that amount is, to try to get you to a goal of budget and sustainability in that sense. It's also to try to get the risks, the relative risks that the beneficiary has, the taxpayers have, that future generations have, to balance that risk in what Americans would think to be an acceptable way. And it's also, you've got to think of it in such a way of reaching the goal of putting the kind of pressure on the healthcare system to do the kind of innovation necessary to live within a tighter budget. And you really want to do that in a kind of sort of Goldilocks and the Three Bears view. You don't want it to be too hard, so you get disruption and so on. You don't want it to be too soft, because then you're not going to hit those budgets. You want to be just right. In some ways. So that's really what you're trying to do in that kind of system of moving to that locus of control. And then finally, you know, if one tries to go down this road, the sort of the premium support approach as a way of trying to solve this this problem, then there are certain key design issues that clearly we've got to consider and think through. And much of the argument about this is about this, and it's not unique to a premium support model. You've got to get the basic amount right, moving towards competitive bidding to set a premium support level, I think is a very important improvement in sort of some of the earlier designs to say that that's how we can get things right in different parts of the country. You've got to make sure that you have an adequate risk adjustment system. Joe Newhouse and others have been working on this for many, many years. This is not a pure science. We're continually learning as we go along. We've got to make it good enough to be reasonable and fair. You want to have, you want to keep Chip out of the room so you don't get actually kind of confused. We need to have a structure of information, others have said, because people can't make good decisions unless there's good information, and that's obviously a challenge. We've got to think very hard about the index in the future. Not only how we set the initial amount, but a lot of the debate over this, of course, is over how do you grow a defined contribution or premium support over time. So it's not that there's any of this is simple, but I think that if you look at the options, the broad options, to deal with the very tough picture that Rick left us with, I certainly feel that, that the most probable way to get an adequate solution among all others, is this way. But I have to end by reminding myself and all of us that we are really talking about probably the least worst approach. It's a little bit like Churchill talking about democracy, as he said in 1947. It's the worst form of government except for all the others that have been tried. And I really think that is the way, unfortunately, despite all of Stuart Altman's efforts all these years, that is the situation that we are in and is really the only way to sort of think about how we can solve this situation in the future. Thank you.
I want to thank the panel and prerogative as the moderator just to ask a couple questions up front before opening it up to the public general audience. The first is that Rick outlined three ways to think about measuring Medicare solvency, and I think it's a really important question. And gets, I think, a little bit to the point that Eugene Storley made in the last panel about how do you measure success. The first being the trust fund, looking at the Part A trust fund. The second, looking at the contribution of general revenue to Medicare. And then the third, the sort of more global approach, can we afford Medicare in the long run? And each of the measures seems to lend itself to a different solution. And given that we're having such a hard time coming to consensus on what the solution is to Medicare, I'm wondering if we can explore a little bit more about the question of how, what the most appropriate measure is for Medicare solvency. And I want to go back to, you know, if you are just looking at the Part A Trust Fund, many of you probably remember the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, where Congress did the brilliant move of moving home health from Part A to Part B. And therefore, the Part A Trust Fund looked a lot better once you moved that whole chunk of spending over to Part B. Which led to, I think, the Republican Congress thinking, well, let's now look at the general revenue contribution. Now that we don't like that move of moving home health over to general revenues, let's put in a trigger based on the contribution of Medicare to, or general revenue to Medicare, that 45% trigger that was later repealed. I don't know that we have solutions that look at the overall affordability of, or sustainability of Medicare in the long run. I know Congress and a couple of you pointed out looked at IPAP, the independent commission in the Affordable Care Act. No one seems to like that at this point. Even people that supported IPAP seem now very interested in revisiting the question of whether that's the appropriate measure. And then premium support, and I think we've also seen revisiting Medicare's cost sharing, looking at the catastrophic, as MedPAC has recommended, a unified deductible, changing the cost sharing. What represents success in Medicare solvency? How do we know when we've solved the problem, particularly after Gene Storily tells us it's not a matter of excess cost growth, which I'm not sure I agree with. I thought that would be a measure of success, but I'd be interested in a little bit more discussion on that from the folks on the panel.
Well, let me start with the sustainability part, and because that's got different dimensions. One aspect of sustainability is, can the country afford it? And that's the kinds of things we talk about. How much do we have to put into it to make it in financial balance? And how much can we afford to put in from a budget perspective? The kinds of things that Gene talked about at the expense of other things we'd like to be spending money on. But there's another aspect, and Mark touched on this, and this gets neglected, but it's really important. The basic Medicare benefit package goes largely back to 1965. Part D got added, and that was a modernization, fairly overdue in the sense of modernizing. But Mark talked about the lack of catastrophic coverage. Every year, hundreds or thousands of beneficiaries go bankrupt because of their cost-sharing requirements under Medicare. So almost every kind of healthcare coverage has catastrophic protection of one kind or another. Medicare doesn't. So in terms of sustainability, do we now have a 1965 Medicare program that doesn't really fit in very well anymore? In which case, we shouldn't be bothering with it. We should be updating it. We should be fixing it. So the sustainability part's broader like that. You measure success, I think, by people think it's an appropriate program and it can be afforded.
I mean, if we're just going down the line, I have long thought that the trust fund structure and sort of judging things through that lens is pointless, you know, particularly given, you know, one is a trust fund, one isn't a trust fund, and you can do things like, you know. So I think the notion, and I'm not kidding around, I'm trying to be careful not to blur the concept, so I think judging success through that lens would not be, and I'm more of the sustainability budget point of view. What is a society do you want to pay for and pay, and are you sticking to that is kind of the way I would think about it, assuming I understood the question. So.
I mean, I agree with Mark on the, you know, on the facts of the matter that is how to think about it from sustainability. But on the other hand, I think, you know, let's be honest about it. The only reason that Congress is focusing on how to do that is because of a trust fund mechanism. I mean, it may mean nothing, it may be a fiction, but that's what Congress is only worried about, the trust fund, in the sense of anything visible that catches any imagination. And that's why there's this difference between, as Rick said, between the way people think about the problem of a trust fund and Part B and dedicated revenue. Part B is not even been on the radar screen for most people. Many members of Congress don't even know this. They actually think that the only thing is the trust fund on the Part A. I mean, they're actually surprised when you tell them.
I got to tell you.
Well, I don't know. Maybe you're talking to different ones than I am. I talk to Republicans, so that may be it.
I have to talk to all of them.
And the only thing I'll say, because I think you're, and I'm sorry to be this way, but I think you're partly right.